There are real advantages from having a strong balance sheet, in other words, a strong net worth position. You come out of recessions much more quickly. You've got a lower cost of debt.
But to have a strong balance sheet, you need to know what your assets are. And well, it seems a lot of governments don't.
The idea that governments don't really know what their assets are worth, it seems kind of startling to me.
Yeah, well, it's a little bit like a chicken and egg kind of situation. Governments don't know what their assets are worth, in large part because of the way they account. They account just for their cash. Most governments don't have balance sheets. They don't know what assets and liabilities they have. My name is Ian Ball. I'm a professor at the University in Wellington in the School of Business and Government. My background is one of financial management in the public sector, both within New Zealand and internationally.
Ian Ball published an article in Finance and Development about the benefits of digging up all government assets, hidden or otherwise. Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Ian Ball to talk about this accounting exercise that's been around for a very long time.
You mentioned in the article, you mentioned some interesting history around this. You talked about how, you know, 1,000 years ago, William the Conqueror, the ruler of England back then, he created this doomsday book, and, you know, where he surveyed all of his lands and assets so that he had, you know, a clear picture of what his kingdom contained. Is this something that European kings used to do back in the old days?
Well, that was very much a one-off, I think. This was a big exercise that was done at the time because the king at the time just wanted to understand exactly what resources he had access to. But the reality for the last couple of centuries is that governments haven't done that. They've just counted what cash has come in and what cash has gone out, and they haven't had a good record of what their assets are.
So when we're talking about assets, what are we talking about? And do we have any idea how much they're actually worth?
There are a range of different sorts of assets, and I guess the first division to make is between financial assets like cash or shares or equities or bonds and non-financial assets. Governments own significant non-financial assets. Particularly, they own a lot of land, but they are often not even aware that they own it. I mean, there's lots of examples of where governments have found that they actually have far more property than they think they do.
And do we have any idea actually globally how much sort of all the governments of the world have in terms of assets?
The IMF estimates they're about twice the value of global GDP, whereas, for example, all the shares and corporates globally are about one times the value of GDP. So globally, governments own very significant assets, but those are very much statistical estimates. You know, our view would be that those are underestimates almost certainly, because to the extent that governments do have information about assets, it's generally what they paid for them maybe decades ago, or they don't have any valuation assigned to them at all. It may just be a nominal value. They say they're going to be in perpetuity held by the government, so they're never going to sell them, so the value is of no consequence.
All right.
I should say that the thrust of the article was not so much about knowing what assets you've got so you can sell them. It's about knowing what assets you've got so you can manage them better, you can use them better.
Right. So, I mean, what's the danger? If governments don't keep an accurate account of the country's assets, what's the danger in that?
Well, the first problem is that they simply don't know what their fiscal position is. They don't know where they really stand now, and that can lead them to make bad decisions. Secondly, if they're thinking only in terms of what cash they spend and what cash they receive, that creates a bias against investing in assets. I mean, even take something like climate change.
Right.
Governments need to know what their fiscal risks are. And if you think about the sorts of land that many governments own, they own land around the coast often.
Right.
And so in order to at least have a sense of what the risks are they face as associated with climate change, they need to know what land they've got. In many cases, they don't have a good idea of that.
Right, because the land that they have is going to lose value if, in fact, oceans start rising.
Both, it could lose value, and they might need to spend money to protect it.
Right.
Protection against rising sea levels, for example.
You mentioned in the article, you mentioned that when governments are better at valuing their assets, that this has an impact on intergenerational fairness. I found that intriguing. Can you explain what you mean by that?
If I think about intergenerational fairness, I think basically it comes down to, are governments eroding their capital or are they building their capital?
Right.
And if they're eroding it, for example, if they're letting their infrastructure decay, then they're using it, but the next generation's going to have to fix it.
Right.
So we need to know what those assets are worth and how well they're being maintained. So there is, for me, a real intergenerational aspect to this.
Yeah.
We do not want to see governments progressively running down the capital that they have. They've certainly done that following the global financial crisis, and they've done that again with COVID. Now, that's not to suggest they shouldn't have responded to both in the ways they do. It's not really saying that. It's just saying that they've now put us in a position where essentially future generations are going to have to carry a lot of the burden. And the difficulty is that we've had a global financial crisis and now COVID. And here in New Zealand, we've had a couple of major earthquakes in between. We can be sure that these shocks are going to continue. We're not at the end of the road for having major economic shocks. So focusing on net worth enables governments to think in a clearer way on what they've got to do and how quickly they want to move to build that capital back up.
Right. And I guess it all plays to transparency, too, right, in terms of what is actually happening, what the government is truly doing in the sum for its residents. This idea of having a total sense as to what the assets were when they came in and what the assets are when they go out.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and associated with the transparency point is the point about accountability. I mean, you can't be held accountable for what's happening to the balance sheet unless you're producing one.
Right.
Because nobody can see what's happening to it. So it really is important for transparency and accountability, but those two also feed into trust. And we're seeing, I think, globally a decline in trust in governments. And it seems to me that a very basic element of that is the government demonstrating what resources it has and how it's using them. And that seems like very basic information that citizens should be entitled to. And they should know that that information is reliable.
Right, absolutely. So you argue in this article that government should have a net worth focus. Can you explain that to me? And how would that benefit the country to have this?
Well, a net worth focus means simply that instead of just looking at debt when you're thinking about a government's fiscal position, you look at all of the items on its balance sheet, you look at its assets, and you look at its non-debt liabilities. And I mean, intuitively, we think in terms of net worth. A bank will evaluate a lending proposal in terms of the whole financial position of the organization or the person. And it's the same with governments. You know, that it's not just what debt they have. A net worth focus means look at their whole balance sheet. Now, what we actually see, when I say it'd be good to move towards a net worth focus, we are actually doing that. That is happening. I mean, the IMF's done some very good work in the last few years on the balance sheet. The World Bank's also getting to focus more on the balance sheet, but it's perhaps happening more slowly than we would like to see. Globally, something like 80% of OECD countries now do report their balance sheet, but only about 25% of them think about that in the budget process. So they budget on a cash basis and report at the end of the year on an accrual basis, that is to say they have full financial statements with a balance sheet.
And so when you say that the IMF and the World Bank are involved in that, does that mean that they are putting a certain pressure or they're encouraging countries to move in this direction?
Yes, they are. And they're pointing out that if you focus on the balance sheet rather than just debt, what the IMF is very clear about is that there are real advantages from having a strong balance sheet. In other words, a strong net worth position. For example, you come out of recessions much more quickly. You've got a lower cost of debt. So there are, even apart from the fact that you might be managing your assets better, you're better off with a strong balance sheet than a weak balance sheet. That means if you want to manage that, you've got to be thinking of, well, what are these decisions doing to our net worth? Because net worth is, if you like, the summary number that tells you whether you're getting better off or worse off. Just as an aside, I mean, what we see in major developed countries like the UK, the US, Canada, is that they went into the global financial crisis with negative balance sheets. That is, their liabilities exceeded their assets. And all of those countries have continued. The position has deteriorated through the period between the global financial crisis and COVID, and has now deteriorated even more rapidly in the period since COVID. So if you're tracking net worth, what you see is a pretty stark picture of governments whose fiscal strength is being seriously eroded, and has been for a couple of decades. And it doesn't have to be like that. We need to get them to focus more on how you work towards increasing your net worth over time.
So are there governments that are doing a good job at this, that are actually taking on this net worth focus and making it work?
Well, I think many governments are starting to think harder about their balance sheet and the structure of their balance sheet and net worth. I think New Zealand is probably the prime example of a government that has a legal requirement to monitor net worth and to have its net worth at a level that will provide a buffer against future economic shocks. And it does monitor it, and it reports it. It actually reports what's happening to its financial position on a monthly basis. So we get monthly financial statements.
Wow.
So that's always kind of front of mind. And I think the example of what happens when you do that is a good example, in the sense that we ran deficits for 20 years before we moved towards a full accrual-based financial system. And then we've had 3 decades since, where apart from the global financial crisis and now COVID, where the net worth has been on a steady upward track. I mean, it moved from a negative position to a positive position, where government net worth was more than 50% of GDP.
And also, I guess you were talking about the fact that there's so much real estate, and that perhaps a lot of governments just sort of forget about the fact that they have all of this land and real estate. Do you think that, you know, factoring that into the accounting makes them consider, well, how can we use this land, this
yes.
real estate?
Yeah, for sure. One of the countries that was first to do this was Sweden, where they really did put all of their commercial assets into a single fund and managed it commercially. And that produced really good results for them. And I think that's probably the primary example. But there are there are lots of other examples at both a local, state and national level, where governments have seen the value of assets that, you know, it might be a railway station, which has been, as in the UK, in London, where the railway station has been redeveloped by the government, but with a lot of private input, and it's become a really hub of economic activity rather than a kind of a derelict wasteland.
Right.
I mean,
right.
So it's that sort of entrepreneurial use of land, which you often don't see in governments.
Right. So it's a different mindset. They start looking at their assets with a different mindset.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And there's huge scope for that. There are so many governments have land that they just don't understand the value of. But there are also other more systemic things about the way governments manage their assets. So, for example, most governments allocate no cost associated with owning assets. And one of the things, for example, that was done in New Zealand was to actually levy a charge on government departments for the use of assets. And that's a mechanism which is basically said to government organisations, you've got to recognise that we've got significant value invested in your organisation, and we expect you to be managing it. And we're going to charge you for the capital that we have invested in you. And that led many of them restructured their balance sheets, got rid of assets they didn't need, replaced them with assets that were more useful. It just forced them to think harder about, you know, how they used their balance sheet.
So, I mean, it does sound like a fair bit of work making all of those shifts and changes. Is one of the reasons governments resist just also because it's a lot of work to sort of change your whole mindset around accounting?
Well, one of the arguments against it is cost. It does cost. There's no question it costs in terms of developing systems, And it costs quite a lot to figure out what your opening balance sheet is. That means you've got to track down what assets you own and what liabilities you have.
Right. And I suppose, you know, perhaps individuals within the government too are resistant to change.
Yes. Well, I think individuals generally can be resistant to change. And
that's true.
This can require a very significant rethinking of how a government does its budget process. I do think that we are on a journey here. And I guess what I'm reflecting probably is a little impatience with how quickly we're moving in that direction. I think that's probably amplified by the fact that we've had two major global crises in the last decade, and they've seriously damaged government's balance sheets. And if we're going to have more shocks, which we are, I mean, climate change clearly is going to be a major shock over the next decades. We want to be in a better position to manage that, and having a strong balance sheet is important in that. And there's been studies which show that companies that had strong balance sheets going into a crisis recover more quickly from it. So it's just part of the risk management processes that government should really go through. They should know what their comprehensive fiscal position is, and that's what they should be managing to.
Well, Ian Ball, I have to say that you have succeeded in making accounting interesting.
That would be good if I had.
despite all odds. So I thank you. I thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast.
Thank you, Rhoda. It's been my pleasure.
That was Rhoda Metcalf speaking with Ian Ball, professor at Victoria University of Wellington in the School of Business and Government. He was the principal architect of the New Zealand government's financial management reforms. He's also the author, along with co-authors John Crompton and Dag Detter, of Mapping the Unknown, an article published in the March issue of Finance and Development. Check it out at imf.org/F&D. And look for other IMF podcasts wherever you listen. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.